From ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. A controversial pardon has been issued by President Trump.
President Trump has issued a full pardon to Scooter Libby. The former chief of staff to Vice President Cheney was convicted in 2007 of lying to the FBI and obstruction of justice in the investigation into the leak of the identity of a former covert CIA operative. In a statement, the president says that while he doesn't know Libby, for years he heard he has been, quote, treated unfairly, and he hopes this pardon will, quote, help rectify a very sad portion of his life. Karen Travers, ABC News. The White House.
UN Ambassador Nikki Haley says chemical weapons were in fact used in Syria as the Trump administration weighs how to retaliate. During an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council, Haley accused Russia of allowing the chemical weapons use by standing behind the Assad regime.
We know who did this. Our allies know who did this. Russia can complain all at once about fake news, but no one is buying its lies and its cover-ups.
The Russian military claims Britain staged the deadly attack. Britain's UN ambassador called it a blatant lie. Lawyers for the president's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, were in court this afternoon asking a federal judge for a temporary restraining order. Cohen wants to stop law enforcement from looking at papers seized during a raid at his office and home. The president reacting after James Comey spoke exclusively to ABC News for the first time since being fired, calling him a slime ball on Twitter. In Comey's book, he compares dealing with Trump to dealing with a mobster. Top White House officials are also weighing in.
If that is exactly how Jim Comey felt at the time, then he should have acted at the time.
Counselor to the president, Kellyanne Conway. A New Jersey man has come forward as the winner of the $533 million Mega Millions lottery jackpot.
We cried a lot together as a family, hugged a lot.
Richard Wall took the cash option, worth over $175 million after state and federal taxes. You're listening to ABC News.
Okay, so the big question for any decision you're going to make, is this actually going to work? Well, if you've heard about MediShare, which is a brilliant way of sharing healthcare costs, you may have wondered that. Does it work? Well, so did Dr. Stuart Hoover, who initially joined to save a lot of money. The typical family saves about $500 a month. Stuart saved even more.
When we first joined MediShare, we were immediately going from a little over $1,600 a month down to $460 basically a month.
So that's wonderful. But then his wife needed emergency surgery and the bills added up to $160,000.
So we were seeing the bills coming in and then the bills were being paid. Portions were being shared. And the end result of this is this bill was taken care of.
Yes, MediShare works, and it's so easy to get your questions answered too. So why not? You can call right now, 877-26-BIBLE. That's 877-26-BIBLE, 877-26-BIBLE.
As we dive into the weekend, there's a new warning about throwing one too many back.
In that international study of nearly 600,000 people, researchers determined that drinking an extra glass of wine or pint of beer over the recommended limit could trim half an hour from an expected lifespan of a 40-year-old. The study in the Lancet Medical Journal says no more than 5 alcoholic beverages a week is best. Any more, researchers warn, raises the risk of a stroke, heart failure, aneurysm, and death. One scientist was quoted as saying drinking above the recommended daily limit is just as bad as smoking. Sharon Reed, ABC News.
And make sure you hit the sack early. Staying up too late can also hurt your health.
Researchers from England's University of Surrey and Northwestern University in Chicago found that night owls are more likely to suffer from breathing and neurological disorders and diabetes. The study's lead author, Kristen Knudsen, has an important message.
You guys need to be a lot more vigilant about maintaining a healthy lifestyle. Eating right, exercising, getting enough sleep, not smoking.
The study shows night owls had a 10% increased risk of death.
Night owls, their clock wants things to happen later, but we worry that people who are night owls are forced to live in a morning lark world.
Knudsen says it's all about your internal body clock and your body's circadian rhythms. Todd Ant, ABC News.
In Kentucky, thousands of teachers are once again protesting. They're unhappy about the governor's plan to veto new money for schools. This is ABC News.
Now today's federal newscast. President Donald Trump sets up a task force to study the U.S. Postal Service. A new executive order states USPS is on an unsustainable path and must be restructured to avoid a taxpayer buyout. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin will chair the board as it looks at how USPS prices its package delivery services. A report will be submitted in 120 days. The Office of Personnel Management reminds federal employees of the resources their agencies have to support victims of sexual assault and violence. OPM says agencies have already taken steps to make sure employees feel safe at work, but they should do more to build on existing policies and programs. President Trump's decision to end labor management partnerships at the Transportation Security Administration are having an effect. That's according to American Federation of Government Employees President J. David Cox. He tells Congress TSA has ended its National Advisory Council, Diversity Advisory Council, and quarterly labor management meetings. Find these stories at federalnewsradio.com and subscribe to the Federal Newscast on Podcast One or iTunes. I'm Eric White.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWTFM HD2 Manassas.
GovEvents.com is your one stop for finding the events that matter for your professional development and organization goals.
Welcome to the Agency in Focus, SOCOM, sponsored by Leidos. Now, here's your host, Tom Temin.
Special Operations Commanders made an appearance before the Senate Armed Services Committee on Emerging Threats and Capabilities. They gave a status report on efforts to transform the Special Operations Force for future security challenges. They also answered questions about how the service components are integrating emerging technologies like artificial intelligence and machine learning. Air Force Lieutenant General Scott Howell, Vice Commander of U.S. Special Operations Command, opened.
As General Thomas testified in February, your U.S. Special Operations Forces are relevant against all our country's national security priorities. With nearly 8,000 members deployed in over 90 countries, our forces are postured, ready, and relentlessly focused on winning today's fights. From countering violent extremism to countering weapons of mass destruction, from rogue regimes to near-peer adversaries, Special Operations Forces continue to provide the geographic combatant commanders options to protect our nation, our allies, and our interests worldwide. However, as the National Defense Strategy outlines, the global security environment is rapidly changing. Correspondingly, SOCOM is transforming at an ever-increasing pace. Today, you'll hear from each of our service component commanders on how their commands are meeting the challenge. Comprising just 2% of the defense budget and 3% of the manpower, Special Operations Forces play a critical role in addressing the nation's priority security challenges and provide an extraordinary return on investment. But as one of our soft truths state, most special operations require non-soft assistance, and the additional support the military departments provide to each of our service components, estimated about $8 billion annually, plays an essential role in the success of our force. The continued support and trust of this committee to U.S. SOCOM and our service components and the military departments has been crucial in maximizing these dividends. And Madam Chair, when you've already introduced my colleagues here alongside us, I will just say these commanders provide superior leadership to their respective organizations and a clear vision for the transformation required to ensure special operations remains at the forefront in addressing emerging threats and capabilities.
Here's General Marshall Webb, commander of the Air Force Special Operations Command.
As United States Special Operations Command's air component, we continuously strive to hone capabilities and evolve our force to remain ready, relevant, and resilient, our three AFSOC priorities. I want to express my gratitude for the resources projected in Presidential Budget 19, as these will fully fund our current requirements and will help us turn a strategic corner as we engage in great powers competition. In line with the National Defense Strategy, AFSOC has the duty and opportunity to shape specialized air power to accentuate both the far low end and high end of the conflict spectrum. As General Thomas testified before your committee 2 months ago, Special Operations' unique capabilities are in high demand across the globe. For 17 years, AFSOC has been laser-focused on counterterrorism operations. This has accelerated the AFSOC operations tempo and has drawn our efforts towards the low end of the conflict spectrum. We realize these efforts are predominantly long-term engagements in which cumulative tactical effects lead to long-term strategic impact. To make such engagements successful, AFSOC must lower the resource and opportunity costs of conducting persistent counterterrorism operations. Conversely, AFSOC operations on the high end are predominantly those that deliver strategic impact in a short amount of time. AFSOC must be capable and flexible in order to confront competitors across the range of potential conflict scenarios. We must develop a force that is more lethal and resilient in contested environments. This brings me to AFSOC's first priority, readiness. AFSOC must build full-spectrum readiness while ensuring that we are postured to fight tonight. We are invested in virtual, adaptive, and realistic training to build readiness beyond traditional means. Using virtual reality to integrate live training environments with simulators reduces training costs, lowers personnel tempo, and engages us to realistically exercise high-end mission sets. Likewise, AFSOCs conducted 78 joint exercises and training events with partner nations in 2017, including our capstone exercise, the recently concluded Emerald Warrior. These events focus on providing complex integration and realistic operational problem sets. AFSOC remains postured to deter, compete, and win against strategic competitors via our second priority, relevance. To meet the challenges enumerated in the National Defense Strategy, AFSOC must cultivate a balanced force for high-end and low-end conflict by investing in new capabilities while leveraging current capabilities in innovative ways. This strategy aims to balance and expand AFSOC relevance across the spectrum of conflict to deter and, if necessary, defeat America's adversaries. AFSOC embraces the process of innovation from within our formation, striving towards a balance of incremental and transformational efforts that are cost-effective and that extend strategic purpose. Finally, our third priority is resiliency. What defines AFSOC is not technology or platforms. Rather, we are defined by our people, active duty, guard, reserve, and civilians alike, and the relentless application of our ethos and strategic values. Tomorrow's fight is unknowable, but one thing is for certain. It must be an integrated joint venture where our creative concepts will win out. AFSOC fervently believes a diverse formation lends itself to this end, and we develop all air commandos accordingly. The readiness and relevance of our force is for naught if we neglect our physical, mental, spiritual, and social fitness. Using SOCOM's Preservation of the Force and Family and the Air Force's Comprehensive Airman Fitness programs, we ensure that our air commando community, including our brave Gold Star families, have access to every possible tool to achieve sustained resiliency, and we exploit every opportunity to encourage our airmen to use these tools. Chairwoman Ernst, Ranking Member Heinrich, members of the committee, AFSOC represents our nation's finest assets and our enduring strategic advantage.
When the topic of emerging technologies was brought up,
it is about technology, but it's also about concepts. And so from Air Force Special Operations standpoint, we kind of have a two-pronged approach. And it's what can we do with our current systems that we have, and from a standpoint of additive capability, which we're still building out, some as we've transitioned a number of our airframes, but it's also about concepts for the usage of that. And so there is a concerted effort that we are doing in conjunction with SOCOM and the Air Force, with Strategic Capabilities Office, DARPA, Air Force Research Laboratory, et cetera, to look at some new concepts and new technologies. And then there's the other leg of what kind of game-changing kind of technology could be applied in that next ridge line out. And without getting into specifics in this forum, that's been the approach at AFSOC I'm very comfortable with.
Next up was Lieutenant General Kenneth Tovo, Commanding General of Army Special Operations Command.
USSOC provides more than 51% of the nation's SOF and consistently fills over 60% of SOF deployments worldwide. The command consists of Special Forces, also known as the Green Berets, our premier practitioners of irregular warfare. Psychological operations, who use the power of influence to shape operational environments. Civil affairs, who conduct civil reconnaissance, mapping of human terrain, and governance and counter-governance activities. Rangers, who specialize in direct action raids and joint forcible entry. And Army Special Operations aviators, who provide a unique rotary wing and ISR capability. Our SOF soldiers are deployed in more than 70 countries on any given day of the year, delivering strategic value to the nation through four complementary capabilities: an indigenous approach, precision targeting operations, developing understanding and wielding influence, and lastly, crisis response. You have asked me to discuss what USSOC is doing to prepare our SOF for both the current and emergent range of threats our nation faces. At the macro level, our nation's threats can be binned in two categories. First, violent extremist organizations that threaten the homeland and other strategic interests. And second, those peer and near-peer adversaries who seek to undermine our global influence and overturn the current international order that preserves our prosperity. The counter-VEO fight has monopolized our global efforts for over 16 years. However, it is clear that competing nations such as Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran will continue to challenge the current international security order to seek greater regional and, in some cases, global influence. USSOC is sustaining the counter-VEO fight while building readiness for peer and near-peer threats by investing in three major efforts. First, we're in the midst of a multi-year effort to restore balance to the force with the aim of improving the health of the force and providing additional time to train against the broader set of tasks that must be mastered to address peer adversaries. Second, we have made significant investments in the intellectual space to ensure that we understand the implications of changes in the security environment and that we find ways to maintain an enduring competitive advantage over our nation's adversaries. Third, the command published strategic guidance, USASOC Strategy 2035, to establish the objectives and framework for developing the capabilities required to move RSOF from the force of today to the force that the nation will need in the future. Competing successfully against our adversaries is demanding. It requires persistent engagement at points of vulnerability around the world. It requires soldiers who understand the political, cultural, and geographic complexities of austere operating environments and the unique challenges faced by our allies and our partners. It also requires an advanced understanding of our adversaries and how they are evolving in an effort to shift the competitive space to their advantage. To meet these requirements and to counter hybrid threats of the future, USASOC will continue to provide the nation with a balanced portfolio of complementary capabilities. Before I conclude, I'd like to thank this Congress for its continued support of SOF, the Army, and DOD. Your efforts to provide budgetary relief are greatly appreciated. Your continued endorsement of critical SOCOM programs such as preservation of the force and family are essential to the resilience and readiness of RSOF. And I'd like to specifically thank the Senate Armed Services Committee for its advocacy for SOF in the 2018 NDAA. The authorities provided under Section 1202 gives SOF the tools required to impede the progress of adversary advances in the competitive space short of war.
And on emerging technologies,
we've done very well, I think, over the years on the incremental changes as new technology comes in to kind of take on what we're already doing and do it a little bit better. About 5 years ago, USASOC stood up a futures staff section designed specifically to look a little deeper in time to understand the implications of technology, demographics, the changing nature of the security environment in general, and then to understand through a wargaming process how that might apply to us, particularly with scenarios against our current set of adversaries with the advent of new technologies, et cetera, so that we can derive those lessons. And so I would tell you that much of what we're doing in that deeper fight is trying to stay connected to industry and to the other experts in the field to understand where these technologies are moving to, not just tomorrow and next year, but what does it look like 10 and 15 years into the future so that we can develop the operational concepts, the doctrine, the techniques, et cetera, as the technology develops.
Leidos is proud to support U.S. SOCOM and its mission to protect America's interests around the world. SOCOM's can't-fail missions can't afford anything less than the latest cutting-edge technology. That's why at Leidos, we develop adaptive and agile solutions, utilizing open systems architecture that rapidly integrates new innovations, ensuring special operations forces have the decisive advantage on the battlefield. At Leidos, we're helping SOCOM achieve mission success today and transform mission readiness for tomorrow. To learn more, visit leidos.com.
We continue our coverage of the Senate Armed Services Subcommittee hearing on emerging threats and capabilities. Next up, we'll hear from Rear Admiral Timothy Szymanski, commander of Naval Special Warfare Command.
Naval Special Warfare is made up of sea, air, land operators, our SEALs, our special boat operators, commonly referred to as SWCC, or Special Warfare Combatant Craft Crewmen, our combat support and combat service support personnel, such as intelligence analysts, cryptologists, communications specialists, chaplain corps, and medical support, amongst the others. We are a mix of active duty, reserve, and civilians. Our nearly 10,000 personnel account for 2.4% of the Navy's overall personnel numbers and 14% of the U.S. Special Operations personnel numbers. Our budget accounts for less than 1% of the Department of the Navy's budget and approximately 12% of the U.S. Special Operations Command budget. As you are aware, and as the National Defense Strategy describes, and as my colleagues have highlighted, security challenges facing the nation today are numerous, and the changing nature of war requires that we change with it. Today, we have more than 1,000 special operators and support personnel deployed to more than 35 countries, facing those challenges, assuring partners, and strengthening alliances. I would like to thank this committee for your support to special operations. As we continue in the longest stretch of armed conflict in our nation's history, congressional support is paramount as we work to maintain advantage over our enemies, protect the nation, and care for the health and well-being of our operators and their families. The first soft truth that humans are more important than hardware remains our guiding principle. We have the best weapons and technology. but our primary weapon systems are now and always have been our operators. We select, train, and sustain men and women of character who are mature, highly skilled, culturally attuned, and trusted to execute our nation's most sensitive missions. It's precisely because of what we ask our people to do, operation after operation, that we never lose focus on their long-term health. Preservation of the force and families, our human performance program, and our latest cognitive health initiatives are about operational readiness, battlefield performance, and the well-being of our force and families. After nearly 17 years of operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, we are focused on strengthening our capabilities as the maritime component to special operations. We are making progress modernizing our maritime mobility platforms that can operate effectively in contested environments. I sincerely appreciate the support from the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Richardson, and his leaders on the Navy staff towards these priorities. In today's world, adversaries are pursuing rapidly advancing technologies in an effort to surpass those of the United States. We, in turn, are relentlessly pursuing innovative solutions to generate effective and lethal capabilities to outpace our adversaries. With our component partners and throughout Special Operations Command, innovation is embedded in every level of our force. Impressively, our most junior operators routinely demonstrate the talent, creativity, and battlefield know-how to move ideas to action. Our focus on innovation is driven by our people, buying down risk to our force while increasing our speed, accuracy, and lethality. But innovation is not just about bringing technology to bear. The National Defense Strategy demands that we think differently, adapt to the changing environment, look for efficiencies and ways to increase our lethality. Optimizing our force is vital to meeting our current operational requirements and providing greater agility and lethality to meet future obligations. Naval Special Warfare places priority on strengthening, equipping, and protecting our people, outpacing our enemies in the employment of new technologies and accelerating trends, and adapting our force to remain agile, accurate, and lethal for many years to come. As a command, we remain vigilant to the resiliency of our operators, support personnel, and their families, and remain committed to our Gold Star families, whose sacrifice we can never repay and whose memory continues to be a source of strength for us. Thank you for your time, your care for all our sailors, and our Naval Special Warfare community.
Szymanski also had some thoughts on emerging technologies.
Most of our organizations were founded to be innovative in concept and not technology. You go back to the history of SEALs and underwater demolition teams, and it was a innovative concept to how we clear beaches to allow amphibious assaults. And we would do that much differently today with the technology that we have. And then secondly, to without getting into some specific platforms, maybe we can talk in closed session, but we are making some great progress, some promising progress in the incorporation of AI and machine learning, particularly in some of our processing and exploitation and dissemination that will cut down analyst time. I think, as the CNO likes to talk about, and two of the rogue or revisionist powers that are mentioned in the National Defense Strategy, both of their leaders have talked about this decision speed, and he who owns AI will be the master. And so I think we're in a race with this incorporation, and it's important, I think, that we continue to press hard on the AI and machine learning.
Leidos is proud to support U.S. SOCOM and its mission to protect America's interests around the world. SOCOM's can't-fail missions can't afford anything less than the latest cutting-edge technology. That's why at Leidos, we develop adaptive and agile solutions, utilizing open systems architecture that rapidly integrates new innovations, ensuring special operations forces have the decisive advantage on the battlefield. At Leidos, we're helping SOCOM achieve mission success today and transform mission readiness for tomorrow. To learn more, visit leidos.com.
Finally, we hear testimony from Major General Carl Mundy. He's commander of the Marine Corps Special Operations Command. He started by giving the Senate Armed Services Subcommittee on Emerging Threats and Capabilities a little bit about his command's history.
MARSOC is the Marine Corps' contribution to U.S. Special Operations Command, and it's the youngest of the four soft service components, having been established just 12 years ago in 2006. However, our roots extend back to World War II, when President Roosevelt, determined to bring the war to our enemies as rapidly as possible, considered the Marine Corps to be an ideal organization for the President's vision of commando operations. So in January 1942, the Marine Corps established two raider battalions with the missions of conducting raids against Japanese-held territory and guerrilla-type operations behind enemy lines. And in that historical mold, MARSOC today produces Marine raiders to conduct full-spectrum special operations to combat complex transregional problems and support geographic combatant commands. MARSOC does this by building upon the unique attributes and ethos that we already bring to the table as Marines. On top of our bedrock Marine identity, we add an assessment and selection process demanding individual skills and realistic world-class collective training to produce agile, enabled, and responsive Marine SOF. Our raiders comprise a tight-knit community of specially selected and trained critical skills operators and combat service support specialists that are task-organized for every mission. Like my fellow component commanders here today, I execute Title 10 authorities as the MARSOC commander to man, train, and equip SOF, and then provide them to SOCOM for missions that support the geographic combatant commanders. Our authorized strength is approximately 3,000 Marines and sailors, along with 200 civilians. Altogether, we represent just over 4.5% of SOCOM, and we account for 2% of its annual budget. Although able to support operations globally, the majority of our forces deploy to Central Command, Africa Command, and Pacific Command regions. MARSOC's base unit of deployment is a Marine Special Operations Company, or MSOC, which we provide persistently on a six-month rotation to each of these regions. On average, MARSOC has approximately 400 raiders deployed across 18 countries performing various special operations tasks. Currently, our special operators average 1 day overseas for every 1.9 days at home, and our capability specialists, such as communicators, intelligence specialists, explosive ordnance disposal technicians, and the like, tend to have a higher tempo that varies from between 1.5 and just less than 1 day at home for every day deployed. While high, this operational tempo is manageable. We continue to benefit from MARSOC's Preservation of the Force and Families program as a critical tool to maintain the health of our force. We pay close attention to the behavioral health of individual raiders and are always looking to expand and innovate the individual programs and services we provide to their families to relieve them of the strains of ordinary life, increase their resiliency, and help them better manage the stresses associated with frequent operational deployments. Our people, not technology or any other particular capability, represent our most precious resource. It's one that we must preserve and cultivate as we look to the future. My priorities within the command reflect both MARSOC's commitment to its people as well as the requirement to develop for the future. They are, first, to provide integrated, full-spectrum SOF. Second, to better integrate the capabilities of SOF with the Marine Corps' air ground teams. Third, to develop MARSOC's future force. And finally, to preserve our force and families. MARSOC is full of supremely talented and dedicated Americans, and I feel especially privileged to be able to represent these fine men, women and men to you today. I'll close by saying once again that it's an honor to be here today and to speak to you about our mission. Thank you as well for what you do for our nation and our military, particularly the support that you provide in terms of funding and oversight.
And on emerging technologies.
Our approach is twofold, kind of near term and far term. In near term, we approach it from an additive capability. Take already existing programs and look to add some of this new technology into it. We have a very small capability development group in our organization, and it's one of the areas that we look to grow here going forward in the future. Our long-term view, I think, like everybody here, is we're on the cusp of machine learning and AI and those sorts of things, how to get in front of that. So we've also published a futures document that looks out about 12 years. It's conceptual and a vision right now. So the next step for us would then be to really put some meat on the bones. We've now written the futures document and begin to develop innovation pathways that allow us to take some of those new technologies and apply them to our concept.
That's Major General Carl Mundy, commander of Marine Corps Special Operations Command, speaking to the Senate Armed Services Subcommittee on Emerging Threats and Capabilities. You can find this episode on our website. Go to federalnewsradio.com, search Agency in Focus. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Agency in Focus, SOCOM, sponsored by Leidos on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. The entire program can be found on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search Agency in Focus.
Leidos is proud to support U.S. SOCOM and its mission to protect America's interests around the world. SOCOM's can't-fail missions can't afford anything less than the latest cutting-edge technology. That's why at Leidos, we develop adaptive and agile solutions, utilizing open systems architecture that rapidly integrates new innovations, ensuring special operations forces have the decisive advantage on the battlefield. At Leidos, we're helping SOCOM achieve mission success today and transform mission readiness for tomorrow. To learn more, visit leidos.com.
As an IT leader in your agency, how you use technology and for what purpose is your responsibility. Are you making the best decisions? Are there better ideas? Federal News Radio's Ask the CIO with Jason Miller, sponsored by Fortinet, has answers. Hear weekly conversations with CIOs, CISOs, and other high-level IT leaders who are continuously making critical IT decisions. Ask the CIO with Jason Miller, sponsored by Fortinet, on the radio Thursdays at 10 and 2 on 1500 AM, and on demand at federalnewsradio.com, Podcast One, and iTunes.
How is the federal government utilizing next-generation technology, such as artificial intelligence, machine learning, and blockchain? To learn more, join the Advanced Technology Academic Research Center, April 17th in Washington, D.C., for the ATARC Federal Emerging Technology Summit, where government speakers and panelists will discuss the use of cutting-edge IT solutions in federal agencies. Register today at ATARC.org. That's ATARC.org.
The following program is produced and furnished by Sean Kelly, who is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Cyber Chat with Sean Kelly, former CISO at EPA and former deputy CIO at Veterans Affairs on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Cyber Chat, where government leaders come to discuss the hottest cyber topics affecting us today. Now your host, Sean Kelly.
Today we're going to be talking to Mr. James Scott, senior ICIT fellow and author of the new book, Information Warfare. James, thank you very much for joining me today, and congrats on the new book.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
No, so I read the book. Great book. Well, I'm going to say I read most of the book. I had to get through the rest of it. Mm-hmm. But one thing that struck me as soon as I picked up the book was you dedicated to your sons, Nigel and Liam.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, this actually started out as a handbook for one of the federal agencies. So there's like two versions of this. What I found was I wanted to red pill my sons. I was never one to read children's books to my kids. I always read things to weaponize their thinking. So I read Art of War, The Prince by Machiavelli, like 48 Laws of Power, this sort of thing to them. Maybe it sounds weird, but they're great kids now, and they have strong minds, you know. And so I took this opportunity. The non-classified version of this we made available for free. And so the way I kind of wrote it was so that when you're experiencing fake news or an influence op, whether it's from a special interest group or a dragnet surveillance capitalist that uses consumer fetishism to like push things on you that you don't need, and the way the media manipulates the minds, you know, I just wanted them to have a handbook to recognize it when they see it and combat it when they can.
So you mentioned the red pill. So anybody who's in cyber knows you're referring to the Matrix.
You know, it's funny. I never saw that movie.
What?
Until after I wrote the book.
Are you serious?
I swear to God. Yeah. And the other movie, what's the other one with that Leonardo DiCaprio guy?
I don't know.
It's another like mind-bending type movie. I watched that after I wrote the book as well. And it's funny because with NATO and in the intelligence community, for meme warfare, you have there's a new term now for an architect, someone that is a social engineer with technical acumen that can do the exploit along, you know, weaponizing digital vectors, whether it's a technical exploit or an information exploit. And it's funny how the term came out of, you know, architect, programmer, you know, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah. So, but let me pull on that thread a little bit, go down that rabbit hole. But we're not being controlled by a massive computer, but in your book, there is a lot that the information, the data we'll be given, the thoughts, and based on the type of person you are, you could be just walking almost down the road that's been meant for us to walk down if you're not really thinking about how you're interacting with the different data elements you meet every single day.
Yeah. Yeah. The way things are right now, and I think last time I was on a show, I said, you know, there's a vulnerability to the narrative. And the vulnerability is the meme. So if you control the meme, you control the information, you control the information, you control the belief system, control the belief system, you control the narrative. And if you can control the narrative, you can control the population. Like, that's how it works. So you have to understand who your target audience is. So first I'll say influence operations abroad, spreading democracy, easing the psychological impact of a tragic event here. Influence operations is a necessity for keeping things from spiraling out of chaos. So it's information. There's a way to target, you know, you don't want to waste space. And I think that, I mean, I'm kind of, this is what I'm doing here in the federal agency space and with NATO and Five Eyes. I'm showing them how to target properly. And the objective is to target the cognitive biases, those psychological and emotional knee-jerk reactions to fear, to whatever. It's the core of what people are. And I think that to do that, I usually will start with spiral dynamics, which gives you the social evolutionary state of the target audience. The next thing is you want to understand the psychoarchetype. So what I found to be most useful is socionics. So I've been pushing that. You can find out who the psychoarchetype pairs, natural alliances are. So within the digital tribal system, you are targeting a particular silo with an ideological variant. You're weaponizing hashtags, using that for information delivery to expedite information delivery. But then you can also see who their direct adversaries are, the psychoarchetypes for them. Especially those are useful when it's a chaos op, for example, when you want both sides to clash. We're seeing that a lot now with the color revolution template that is being used all over the place by, you know, China, Russia, Iran, and the special interest groups domestically. So, the metadata is another thing. So the metadata is curated by these corporations, and it's just gotten completely out of hand, because then you can psychologically steer the perceptions of everyone. And now you see machine learning and artificial intelligence, deep learning injected into bot technology. Mm-hmm. And so now this is steering the perception, manipulating cognitive biases. It's just, we got almost 2 million downloads already, and it's been like, I don't know, a month or two, something like
that. Yeah.
So it's that, I don't know, does that answer your question?
No, it does. It does. And you know, and we'll get into it, but the mem is, I look at it, and I never, I totally look at it now through a different lens, that I read the book. I don't even know if I gave it that much attention, but you also make the point in the book that there are people that will, and they'll look at it totally different. And it really just depends on, you know, are you one of those people who looks at things and I guess it also comes down to what you already believe looking at that, you know, but do you really think, you know, and I know there's a broad discussion across, I guess, the collegial environment of how impactful they are, because different meanings can be taken from different people looking at them. Go ahead. Yeah, please. Yeah,
let me tell you. When I was writing this and I was testing processes, I was like, all right, well, you can write about, but let's start using some of these techniques. So I saw from a particular news show, they posted a video on YouTube of this complete mind midget automaton. They were trying to normalize this individual. And I'm like, wow, this is what news is now. This isn't just fake news. This is mind-bending, mind midget automatons. And so I'm like, all right, here. I did a tweet with their handle and a hashtag, a particular hashtag. And I put it through a five-hour cycle of an influence op. The very next day, they took the hashtag that I used, re-weaponized it, and was paying Twitter to promote it, and it went viral. That, just a few hours. And that was nothing. It was nothing. You know, and so your ideas and beliefs are not original from your mind. It's your parents. It's the different political silos that you associate with. It's the ideological variant of religion. It's the level of religiosity. It's the level, you know, and so it's all these outside packets of information that become normalized. You know, they then bypass the critical faculty. They get into your subconscious and become part of your automatic reactionary system, you know? So yeah, I think your thoughts and everything come from other people, and the meme is the embryo of this thing.
Okay. My guest today is Mr. James Scott, Senior ICIT Fellow and author of the new book, Information Warfare. I am Sean Kelly, and this is Cyber Chat on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
We're covering the news that's critical to your career. Experience the difference of the journalists at federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Cyber Chat on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. My guest today is Mr. James Scott, Senior ICIT Fellow and author of Information Warfare. James, before we talked about the meme, we talked about the embryo, we talked about how this all comes together. And one of the things that I believe is that 20, 30 years ago, news was like, you know, dragnet, right? Stick to the facts, only the facts, right? And now news has become entertainment. Mm-hmm. We've seen some prestigious newscasters no longer on the air because they embellished the reporting. And so the higher ground of the news establishment seems to have deteriorated to some degree, which I believe has opened up for these other venues to come in. And they don't all follow the same standards that we expect of our news cycles. Mm-hmm. Is that really where we are today?
Yeah. You know, you look at the reality that we're the tragic inheritors of a mass hallucination that was started and perpetuated by Eddie Bernays, who was Sigmund Freud's son. So he used consumer fetishism to get people to buy things. So he was the originator of propaganda and PR and stuff. So over time, he found that he could simply use the media, weaponize it against the viewers or listeners or readers. And that's where you have the idea of traditional broadcast media, traditional media, mainstream media. So he used like the newspapers, the radio, and TV. And news has always been fake news to a certain degree. It has always been that way. It's a way to steer perception. The military-industrial complex uses it to facilitate Hegelian dialectic operations, to take tragedy, weaponize it for the benefit of capitalism. You know, this sort of thing. And so the news has, the broadcast media, they've never really been journalists. They're news readers. Somebody's talking into the ear. They're regurgitating what they hear. A producer's giving them the information. You know what I mean? So they're not coming up with anything original. And, you know, I think that there has been a deterioration with the confidence that people had in this narrative illusion. But I think that now we have so many options. And, you know, we talked about this before. Like, we're no longer a world that's divided by geographic lines in the sand, that these two men, one fought a war. Now there's this border, and everybody respects that geographic, you know, line in the sand. We're ruled by a digital tribal chieftain society that's siloed into ideological variants. And so you now... we're becoming more and more polarized because people are being pulled into deeper and deeper into this virtual reality, you know? And this is where the whole information warfare, the digital information warfare, digital psyops, we're seeing a digital, digitized gamification of a psyop with the QAnon thing. You know, that started out as a real insider, mm-hmm. and now it's like a psyop, pretty much, you know.
Yeah. So let's pull that string on information warfare. Mm-hmm. Is we have domestic and we have foreign. Mm-hmm. Okay. Domestic is mostly for a political advantage or an ideological advantage or a financial advantage. Mm-hmm. I mean, for the most part. But then we also have the foreign, mm-hmm. right? Where are we seeing a decrease in the overt cyber incidents, and we're shifting more to an information warfare stance where we're going to try to influence how people think versus just completely going after intellectual capital or intellectual property.
From a hacking perspective?
Yes, from an actor's perspective.
Domestic or abroad?
Abroad.
I think domestic. Yeah, well, I think domestically, I think you see psychological warfare, information warfare, and influence operations done specifically with political campaigns. That's where I'm seeing it done for the most part here. And then if there's like tragic events, for example, you saw, for example, CNN completely controlled the mainstream narrative with the unfortunate incident at the Florida high school.
Parkland, yeah.
Yeah, they were literally scripting everything towards the anti-Second Amendment agenda. And that is an agenda. You could go on and on about that whole thing. But I think the technological abroad, as far as cyber warfare, information warfare, I think that hacking is going to continue to hyper-evolve. We just launched Center for Space Warfare Studies. I was with friends from NASA last night. We're just like getting all that moving. That SATCOM interception, there's virtually no cybersecurity whatsoever.
Okay.
With satellites and signals, intelligence, interceptions, manipulation, forgery. They haven't even gotten to the endpoint security aspect now to get past the to beat down the mutating hash using artificial intelligence and machine learning, which they should. You would think if you're going to spend $1 billion on a satellite, you know. But I think we're going to continue to have offensive cyber missions. But now, what we're doing, it's this will not be won by governments, because governments can't turn on a dime. They can't pivot quick enough because they're just too bureaucratic. Mm-hmm. And they're too politically siloed within the agencies to be effective in both the mental exploit and the technical exploit. So I think that we're going to start seeing a combination of mercenaries that are social engineers with severe, potent technical acumen. They're going to weaponize digital vectors and distribute things like ransomware, malware targeting critical infrastructure executives with elevated privileges, or politicians with, a keylogger and hot mic camera activation, stuff like that on the computer so you can listen in. There's a lot of black ops, espionage type thing. But you're also going to have the more digitized a nation becomes, the more susceptible they are to perception steering and information warfare. And, you know, on that note, I was in one of the agencies yesterday, and we're dealing with the Chinese colonization of Africa. And they're doing it for agricultural reasons, all this kind of stuff. And for me to advise on this, on psychological warfare with digitized psychological war, it's difficult because there's no technological infrastructure. So we have to build it first.
Okay.
And so now we're going through the agencies to bring money into Africa. So, you know, you have the surveillance capability. You have you can monitor the Chinese activity, you know, and what they're doing, what type of economic viability are they bringing to this situation? That'll take at least 10 years to have an impact there, because mm-hmm. you're looking at Ghana, you're looking at. So, yeah, I think that we're heading into a space where in Asia and Europe and the U.S. and South America, the technological infrastructure is there in a way where you can have potent cyber war and potent digitized information warfare.
Outstanding. My guest today is Mr. James Scott, ICIT Fellow and author of Information Warfare. I am Sean Kelly, and this is Cyber Chat on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
We're covering the news that's critical to your career. Experience the difference of the journalists at federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Cyber Chat on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. My guest today is Mr. James Scott, Senior ICIT Fellow and author of Information Warfare. James, we've been talking about your new book, and we were talking about it as a cookbook, right? Mm. And I have gone through, I would say, 75% of it. I want to go back and read it more carefully. Mm. Tell me, from the moment I start reading that book until I get to the end, one, what is it that I should be taking away, and how do I use it?
Yeah. I think one thing that I think is easiest to start with is to use the techniques, talking about the social media, after you understand how you're being targeted, you can understand, like, I think that's in the beginning of the book, like, the manipulation of cognitive biases, spiral dynamics, the socionics, psychoarchetypes, the weaponization of metadata against you. This is being, I want people to first understand that this is being done now. I say this all the time. Dragnet surveillance capitalists that became Dragnet surveillance propagandists and are now a corporate nation-state censorship collective. So they are, they have you under surveillance. You are, they're putting propaganda out there, their perception steering, and, you know, they are censoring the content that you see. This is what everyone, every nation-state wants. If you can control the information, you control the mind because you limit what they're getting access to. So after they see how they're being targeted, I really want them to understand the the weaponization facilitation of the vectors. Like on Twitter, the weaponized hashtags, the illusion of a viral tweet with using bot technologies, artificial intelligence and machine learning, injected into bot technology for the illusion of a viral comment thread with 100 retweets, 1,000 likes, and then the sharing, you know. Yeah, and then you have that on Facebook, you have it on YouTube. You know, I think that's the main stuff. And then I think it's a weaponizing of the mind. If, you know, we've had people that just, I was at a Grover Norquist meeting yesterday. I've been asked me back 3 times just to talk about the Chinese warfare and stuff like that. And afterwards, they had asked me to do a talk. Actually, it'll be on our YouTube channel soon. And there were people just thanking me just for opening their minds to this. You know, I feel like I was just like a vessel just trying to do something right. It was, and so the cool thing that I also am seeing is that people are making memes. So I get a ton of emails where they're like, would you mind if I use your picture and can I put quotes on here? I'm like, look, as long as it's taken in context, I mean, some people go a little nutty with it, like scratching my eyes out and stuff and putting these quotes from that I, you know, that I was saying I thought was on the down low, but I guess it kind of looks cool.
Yeah.
But they're making memes. Now, whatever political, ideological variant silo they're in, I have people on the very far left that are doing memes in support of my work.
Yeah.
Other stuff, too. Like, they're watching videos. They're learning about cybersecurity.
Yes.
They're learning about nation-state cyber warfare. They're learning about legislation, like the Cyber Shield Act and, like, important stuff, Graham Klobuchar Amendment. And then you have people on the alt-right that are saying, quote-unquote, pray for this man. Like, it's like, wow, what, do I come across like I'm that nutty? But it's really rewarding to see people kind of using me as their guinea pig to make memes. And I try to support it. I try to retweet them. I can only retweet so many until I look like I'm arrogant or something. I'm trying to support what they're doing.
So. No, I get it. Yes, the book is very enlightening, right? And a lot of the things that we talk about or you talk about on the YouTube channels is as well. But then we still have the problem, right? Mm. So if domestically and foreign, we're being bombarded with a whole bunch of misinformation, right? How do you get the right information?
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I did an interview with this after the event, after our Winter Summit, I think. And a couple things. So if you're a Fox viewer, for example, you're choosing to hear a purely conservative narrative that's going to continue to bring you in and in and in deeper and deeper and deeper into that ideology, right? That's a lot of control that Fox will have over you, over your thinking, because they'll take something that maybe you don't necessarily agree with, but they'll normalize it to the extent where psychologically and emotionally you're accepting this as your narrative. So I tell, look, if you watch Fox, don't watch CNN. Just Don't watch CNN. If you hate yourself, watch CNN. But watch MSNBC or something really progressive and watch them both equally. And what you'll find is that your mind will go from just far right ideology and you'll see how many things you have in common with people on the left. Mm-hmm. And what'll happen is you'll come together and you'll start creating your own narrative and you'll be less dependent on everyone feeding you the narrative. And the same thing if you're on the far left, watch Fox. Yeah. You might not like it, but it'll be torture. But after a month, you'll be like, wow, this actually works. If you're a Rush Limbaugh guy, listen to whatever, Morning Joe or something.
Yeah. So I think basically what you're saying is listen to both sides of the argument. You know, make sure that you're not just getting one side of any story.
And you can't and I tell this with NATO in particular because they try to be offensive from the defensive position because they're a defensive organization. So I tell them you can't inoculate this from happening. You have to inoculate it in the mind. So it's education. This book's a good start for education.
It is.
Yeah, I think. I hope.
No, I think it's very well written. So we have a couple minutes left. Let's talk about ICIT. Mm-hmm. There's a summit coming up in June at the Mandarin Hotel in Washington, D.C. What else is coming up?
Well, today we launched Center for Space Warfare Studies. So we have, I'm writing a book on that now. We're talking about the weaponization of space, defense of American assets, cyber attack, hacking. So that's cool. We have Center for Cyber Influence Operations Studies, which is a study of propaganda in a digital setting using weaponized vectors, the same vectors that are being used for hacking. We've been doing, like with Centrify, you had Greg Cranley in here earlier. We're doing dinners throughout the country where we're doing, I think we're calling them intelligence briefings. So we're giving them non-classified briefings, but it's major C-level executives that are coming to these small dinners. So I sign books and do one of those fireside chat things with Parm. Mm-hmm. And we're doing a lot at RSA. I'll be signing books at like different booths and stuff for companies to bring traffic. You had Josh Phillip in here from Epoch Times. He is one of the most, he's a very good friend, and he's one of the hardest hitting investigative journalists because he's ruthless. He's ruthless. So I'm going up there next week and we're going to do some more video stuff. I'm going to do some media with them. I'm working on a thing right now. I can't talk about it with them because I don't want to blow it for them, but it has to do with the book.
Okay.
And lots of really good things happening. Our advisory is growing like crazy. We're in most of the agencies that deal with hacking, and we have full advisory schedule for ICIT, full advisory schedule for SIOS, and now for space warfare. You know, so it's going really well, man.
You guys have a lot of research. Where do listeners go to find that research?
Yeah, we make it available for free. And so it's either on the blog or the publication link on icitech.org.
My guest today has been Mr. James Scott, Senior ICIT Fellow and author of Information Warfare. You can find his book on Amazon. I am Sean Kelly. Thank you for listening. You can follow me on Twitter at Mr. Sean Kelly. We will see you next month. Thank you.
You've been listening to Cyber Chat with Sean Kelly. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show at federalnewsradio.com. Search Cyber Chat.
The Federal News Radio Community Spotlight is the PenFed Foundation, celebrating their Night of Heroes Gala. This inspiring event honors heroes from the corporate, nonprofit, and military worlds and raises much-needed funds to support our nation's defenders. The PenFed Foundation seeks to meet the unmet needs of service members, veterans, and their families, because military heroes need heroes too. The PenFed Foundation Night of Heroes Gala on Wednesday, May 2nd. Tickets and sponsorship opportunities available at PenFedFoundation.org.
Tune in each weekday morning at 6. Tom Temin brings you the latest agency news from across the government, reports on congressional action, and developments affecting your pay and benefits. Hear interviews with people making, analyzing, and helping you understand the news.
Start off your weekday informed and stimulated.
It's the Federal Drive with Tom Temin, weekday mornings at 6 here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Latest updates for the armed services and defense contractors. Get our DoD reporter's notebook, federalnewsradio.com. Search alerts.
WFED Washington, WTOP FM HD2 Washington, WTLP FM HD2 Braddock Heights, Frederick, federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.